I have to go upstairs and record something again, so
quiet.
Quiet and do not
smash anything.
And do not disturb.
Do not disturb.
Do not come into your room.
Hi, you're listening to Pandemic, a new podcast from RTE News and Current Affairs on the COVID-19 crisis. I'm Cullum O'Mungoyne, and most days of the week I'll be talking to RTE's correspondents, reporters and others to bring you news, updates and analysis you can trust. We can guarantee you a high quality of information. The sound quality, on the other hand, might vary somewhat sometimes, as correspondents and I will be recording this, in many cases, on mobile devices from home, so please do bear with us. It's Wednesday, May 13th, and as we record this episode in the mid-afternoon, over 293,000 people have died around the world with COVID-19. 1,488 of those people have died here in Ireland. In this episode, we'll be having a look at what the Health Information and Quality Authority has to say about children with our health correspondent Fergal Bowers. But Dr. Maureen Ryan, the Deputy Chief Executive of HICWA, was speaking on RTE's News at One earlier. And listener, if you're locked down with a brood of your own, you may be surprised to hear, or not, that children are no more dangerous than anyone else.
While it's a very limited evidence base, it's just 7 studies, because as we know, this is a very new virus and there isn't substantial evidence available to us yet. But what is there does suggest that children do play a role in transmitting the virus, but there's no indication that they transmit it at a substantially higher rate than any other individuals in the population.
Now, speaking of children, we're going to have a look in a bit of depth in tomorrow's episode on what the thinking is on schools with our education correspondent Emma O'Kelly. But back to today, the legal action mounted by former journalists turned campaigners turned electoral candidates, now litigants John Waters and Gemma O'Doherty, was dismissed in the High Court today in blunt language. Orla O'Donnell, our legal affairs correspondent, has the details of that. And political correspondent Paul Cunningham has been looking over the EU's advice on travel for the coming summer months. But any move in this country towards lifting restrictions on travel or indeed anything else will be dictated by the levels of disease in the community and the state of play in hospital beds, particularly intensive care units. So to check in on that, our health correspondent Fergal Bowers is here on the line. All right, Fergal, how are you?
I'm good. I suppose everybody's watching towards the end of the week when the National Public Health Emergency Team meets again on Friday to hear, are they going to, effectively advise the government that it's good to go next Monday for the first phase of lifting of restrictions. So everyone's watching the figures and the statistics now as we head towards Friday.
Well, maybe we'll start off there, because one of the things we look at every day, I mean, people often hear us talk about numbers, but the hospital numbers are one of the key indicators there. So obviously you can't predict what NPHET are going to say, but in terms of informing their thinking, how are the hospital numbers going?
Well, the situation in hospitals with COVID-19 cases, it does continue to ease considerably, I think we'd say that. The number of confirmed or suspected cases in hospitals, it's now down by 60 patients. So it's 764 patients overnight. And the hospitals with the most cases are the Mater, St. James's and Tallaght in Dublin, but with reducing numbers each day. And then if we look at the number of patients in intensive care units, that's down further to 67. And there are 148 critical care beds vacant in hospitals, which is a reasonable capacity in terms of where we are at now. And so all of those figures, along with the trend in cases, are encouraging. And they also should allow the hospital system generally to help return to start dealing with some of the priority non-COVID-19 care.
The Health Information and Quality Authority, also known as HICWA, Fergal, they've been doing a review. So who asked them to do the review, first of all? And we'll go through the findings after that. What was the purpose of this particular review that they did?
Well, they regularly conduct health technology assessments of, various treatments and devices. But the expert group, which advises the National Public Health Emergency Team, did ask the Health Information and Quality Authority to do these type of reviews. So, it's important and it has been tasked with doing this work as we progress in trying to deal with the virus. They've published a number of reports before, and they've published a number today, and one of the key ones today is in relation to children and COVID-19.
Yeah, children, people, there was some nervousness around children, and it might have grown up on the kind of erroneous premise that children were some kind of super spreaders because they weren't badly affected by COVID-19. They may have been asymptomatic carriers and as a result of a higher risk. But in terms of being bigger spreaders than others, HICWA has kind of put paid to that with a caveat.
Yes, I mean, there are caveats here. It's important to emphasise that this HICWA review, it involves a small number of studies regarding children. So it's seven studies. And so it has limitations. That's very important to be aware of it. And so obviously caution is advised in drawing major conclusions. But HICWA is a statutory watchdog, and it was asked to do this work, and it's published some major reports. And of course, COVID-19 is a new virus and it isn't fully understood. But from the limited evidence HICWA has published today, it says that evidence points to children not substantially contributing to the spread of COVID-19 in households or in schools. But of course, children do play a role in transmission of the virus, but there's no evidence they transmit at any higher rate than others, certainly. And then if you look at the figures just here in Ireland from the Health Protection Surveillance Centre, in those under 14 years of age, we have seen over 380 cases of COVID-19. Two children were admitted to intensive care units, but thankfully no deaths have been recorded. And it is interesting that, coincidentally, I think really, a short time ago, the Taoiseach Leo Varadkar said the emerging evidence was that reopening schools and childcare is among the safest things to do over the coming months, but would have to be done safely.
Yeah, presumably social distancing, and however the school authorities are going to get their head around all of the things that need to be done to have 30 people being taught a particular subject at the same time, that's a conundrum that's going to have to be cracked ahead of September.
It is going to be difficult, and that, and you know, for example, we were saying, I think recently, how couldn't you have 30 people, say, in an outpatient department ever again, or 30 people in an emergency department room ever again, while COVID-19 remains and there's no treatment or there's no vaccine? So it is a challenge. There were some other interesting things that HICWA published today in terms of its assessments too. It said that while some individuals have tested positive after recovering, that's likely due to the virus being redetected in their bodies rather than reinfection with a second virus. So that's interesting. And HICWA also said that, you know, from looking at the evidence around the world, it's not yet certain if antibodies to the virus are transferred from the mother, if the mother has been infected, to the child in the womb via the placenta. That is of interest. And then I suppose the other main point from their work today is that with other serious coronavirus infections, the antibody response to being infected is usually maintained for one or 2 years after the initial infection, and then it decreases. But we don't know what this COVID-19 does. And that's kind of interesting because in relation to influenza, you know, you get vaccinated every year for the twists and changes in the strains of viruses, and you do retain something of the previous protection. But we just don't know what sort of level of immunity this virus gives people if they are infected.
I think there wasn't there a figure of maybe 8 weeks thought to be some form of immunity for the 8 weeks following infection. Maureen Ryan from HICWA was on the News at One earlier saying, but that beyond that, for a further period of months, any form of, as you were outlining there, a longer term immunity, that's by no means sure.
So yes, the available evidence here, well, again, all the limitations apply with regard to the evidence base, but what it does seem to indicate to us, which is a positive, is that people who are infected with the coronavirus that causes COVID-19, that they do mount an immune response, they do produce neutralizing antibodies, and that those antibodies seem to persist for at least 8 weeks. And there are studies, continuing studies underway, that will investigate whether or not that immunity persists for any longer than 8 weeks, and we hope that it does.
And that's going to pose a huge challenge, because that's 8 weeks is a very short space of time. in terms of, you know, people being protected. So that does mean the in the months ahead, if that's the case, you know, there is a particular challenge. The other interesting point I raised last night at the briefing at the department was I was asking about the summertime, because everyone can see the weather is picking up, it's getting hotter. And, you know, with a bit of luck, Ireland will have a nice summer this year. I think everyone would like to see that, given what everybody has been going through and continues to go through. So the question is, how much does hot weather and a hot summer affect the virus? So, well, no one's really sure, it seems to be, is the answer. With influenza, for example, we always see a drop in cases in the summer. Now, that's not fully understood why, but it is seen. But this, again, is a new virus. And Dr. Killian de Gascoigne was saying last night to that question, we don't know how it will act over the summer. But, for example, it's likely this virus wouldn't survive very long on hot surfaces. So you'd have hotter surfaces in the summer. And people will be outdoors, of course, during the summer if it's nice. But it won't be a normal summer here, because, you know, you'll have social distancing and the changed behaviours that people have, even as restrictions are lifted slowly. So it's going to be very interesting to see, does the virus act like other viruses and flu, and does it drop off during the summer weather?
There was also some look had, I think, at last night's briefing, Fergal, on the turnaround times for tests as well. Was there some measure of improvement being committed to there, or some level of optimism about improving the turnaround times for testing?
Well, look, testing, you know, over a quarter of a million tests have been done. And it's not a capacity issue in terms of delays and problems. The testing delays seem to be due to a number of things, like a lack of automation and other problems. You know, scaling up a brand new testing service and tracing service in 8 weeks, quite a challenge. And a number of manual steps are involved, so that makes it difficult. And also human error, there are transcription errors, and some telephone numbers, or not all telephone numbers, are correctly or obtained at all. And contact tracing, there are problems there, we're told, particularly in long-term care facilities. So if you're dealing, for example, with vulnerable patients who may have some communication difficulties, it might take some time to precisely track down who they've been in contact with and how they're to be contacted. So we're told by the HSE, you know, no single issue is at the heart of it. But they're looking at the moment, you know, test swab testing and contact tracing. It's usually, the process is taking about 5 days or so. They want to bring it back down to 3 days, and then ideally, you know, 24 to 48 hours to have a slick testing system. But hospitals also operate on different computer systems, and some of those computers don't talk to each other. So, you know, it is a problem. But some level of automation is going to kick in from next Monday, and that will include notifying close contacts that they have been in contact with a confirmed case. So it's improving, but the system, you know, it isn't perfect yet, that's for sure.
Any word on the app, Fergal, then, finally today? Because we haven't really touched on this in detail, and it might be a subject we could go into in another episode of this podcast. But is there any progress report on the app, how that might be reconciled with data protection concerns, how it might work? Or
so the last thing we're told is the app will be voluntary anyway, firstly, and it'll be part of, you know, dealing with contact tracing, but it won't be the solution. And I think they're still talking with Google and Apple in relation to the development of it, and also with the Data Protection Commissioner to make sure those issues you're talking about are sealed off. So there's an assessment being done by the Data Protection Commissioner. There will be, as what we're told is, at the end of May, probably a pilot soft launch of it to see how it works. But again, you know, it will be voluntary. And for example, if you downloaded the app and you were found to test positive, you know, you'd be asked to voluntarily supply information that the phone has in relation to the contacts you've been with. And what would happen then is that the system would then contact those contacts and ask them, you know, do they give permission for you to contact them? and notify them that they've been in contact with someone who has had the virus. So we did get a sense at the briefing that, you know, initially the app sounded like it was going to be something of a major player, I suppose, in terms of contact tracing. I think it's fair to say that it'll be there and it'll have, you know, some sort of contribution, but it won't be the be-all and end-all. It's, you know, contact tracing will be the key job of the authorities.
All right, Fergal, thanks very much.
Take care of yourself.
Cheers. All the best. Now, next to the High Court, where former journalists, now anti-lockdown campaigners John Waters and Gemma O'Doherty heard some of the arguments on which they based their legal action dismissed as bogus, absurd and offensive. Their case was thrown out by Mr Justice Charles Meehan, our legal affairs correspondent, Orla O'Donnell, who has been on coronavirus duty for the last while, stuck back on her legal hat and has been going through the 31-page ruling. Let's hear from her now. How are you, Orla?
I'm fine, thanks, Colm.
Good. OK, well, look, I'm having a look at the story you had online today. Will you give us the background to this particular case, Orla, where the ruling was delivered today?
Well, they were seeking the permission of the court to bring judicial review proceedings, and they were challenging the constitutionality of the legislation and the regulations enacted as part of the government's plans to stop the spread of COVID-19. And they were also challenging the steps taken and the procedures followed by the Oireachtas. They were claiming that the legislation was unconstitutional and flawed. They wanted the legislation quashed. They said the laws enacted amounted to an unprecedented suspension of constitutional rights. And when you're taking judicial review proceedings challenging legislation or challenging decisions by the government, you have to show that you have, first of all, that you have standing in the case, so that you are affected by the proposed, by what has happened, and also that you have an arguable case that that can be made, that has a prospect of success. And the burden is on the people taking the case or looking for the permission to take the challenge to prove that they could have an arguable case if the matter went to a full hearing. It's quite a low threshold. It's a low bar to get permission to take judicial review proceedings, but the judge pointed out that it was a threshold all the same.
So they jumped the first fence. They were obviously affected by this. Everybody's affected by the legislation.
Yes.
So there's that hurdle crossed. The issue as to whether or not it was arguable, this doesn't enjoy the same standard of whether you could start an argument in your local pub over it. It's a different kind of a standard applied.
It's low enough, though. I mean, you just have to prove that you don't have to show that you would win your case, but just that you have enough of a case that has a prospect of success. And that's what they had to show to the judge to get permission to take the judicial review. It's called leave proceedings, or permission to go on and take the full judicial review, the full challenge.
OK, so what were they arguing and what was the reaction of the judge in his ruling today?
Yes, well, the judge, Mr. Justice Meehan, he said that the legislation, yes, it did undoubtedly restrict people's constitutional rights, but he said these rights were not absolute. And he said if you were going to make an arguable case that restrictions and limitations on rights were disproportionate, you had to put on affidavits, you had to swear documents showing some facts which, if proven, could support such a view, so showing that you had an arguable case. And he said there was a complete failure by Ms. O'Doherty and Mr. Waters to do so. He said they were questioning the accuracy of figures for people who infected, the number of deaths reported. They were claiming the science relied on by the Minister for Health was fraudulent. But he said other than their views, they didn't put forward any supportive expert opinion. For example, the Minister for Health filed a sworn document by Ms. Bernie Ryan, the principal officer in the Department of Health, which set out in detail the background and the reasons for the legislation. And the judge said the applicants did not seek to reply to this affidavit. He said they had no medical or scientific qualifications, and yet they were maintaining the numbers were overstated and this was fraudulent science. But there wasn't any factual basis or any supporting expert opinion put forward to support this. And he said that they were relying on their own unsubstantiated views, giving speeches, engaging in empty rhetoric, and that they sought to draw an historic parallel with Nazi Germany. And he said this was absurd and offensive. And he went on to say that unsubstantiated opinions, speeches, empty rhetoric, and a bogus historical parallel were not a substitute for facts.
And some of the information they presented to the court was past its best before date.
Yes, they had they had submitted a statement which is required to ground their application, and it set out a narrative of events, what had happened on each day. And this narrative ended on March the 16th. Now, the judge said at that stage there were 268 confirmed cases and two deaths. But he said that applicants did not go on in any further documents submitted to bring this sequence of events up to date. And when the action was heard in the High Court, he said there were 22,248 people infected and 1,375 deaths.
And it wasn't just about the legislation being repugnant to the Constitution, as they argue. That wasn't the sole basis of their case. They were saying that the means by which this legislation came into being was not proper.
Yes, well, they were particularly concerned about the legal standing of the government. Obviously, we've had an election. There's a caretaker government in place, and they made an issue of the fact that three government ministers were no longer members of Dáil Éireann. Now, the judge's view on this was non-justiciable. It was something that couldn't be decided upon by the courts, because he said if the court were to start hearing such a complaint, that would be a clear breach of the principle of the separation of powers. He went on to say that the Constitution makes it clear that the government remains in office until a successor government is appointed, that the Taoiseach and other members of the government shall continue to carry on their duties. And he said that the fact that a number of members of the current government are no longer members of the Dáil doesn't affect that. And he said it couldn't be doubted that one of the duties of the government was to take steps to address the issues that arise from the pandemic. He said that they had made out no arguable case against the Dáil, Shannon, and the Cam Coil of the Dáil. And he would go even further and say the case they were seeking to make was unstateable.
Right. Now, at least one of the parties, there was John Waters and Gemma O'Doherty, but Ms. O'Doherty has indicated that she intends to appeal this ruling.
Yes, well, they had said during the case that they would appeal if the court ruled against them, and they have been saying that they anticipated that the court would rule against them. And they, in a tweet after the judgment was issued, Gemma O'Doherty said that she has, as anticipated, the judge had rejected their application. And she said, "We will lodge our appeal shortly, and our fight for justice continues stronger than ever." Of course, a question that many people want to know the answer to is who pays the costs of all of this? Now, Gemma O'Doherty and John Waters were representing themselves, so they don't have to pay lawyers. But usually if a party loses a case, then they have to pay the legal fees pertaining to the other side. So the judge has asked the parties to the case for submissions on issues, in particular in relation to costs.
And there was a kind of an extraordinary amount of political theatre around this case leading up to it in the hearings that we had, to the point that the court service became alarmed at the number of people who were turning up. And this also became a point of argument, whether or not a crowd of supporters in the court should be allowed in order for the justice to be seen to be done in public. That was argued by the plaintiffs.
Yes, and it's obviously a very important tenet of our justice system that justice should be administered in public and that people should be able to see what's going on. But the problem is, of course, courtrooms, you know, even in the best of days, can be very small for the groups of people that want to turn up. Even on a normal day without a pandemic, a group like this would have been difficult to accommodate them in the courts, in the round hall, in the four courts. They're built for a different time. And usually the media are the people who are the eyes and ears of the public. On some of the days when this case was being heard, dozens of supporters turned up and were trying to seek gain access to the courtroom. And once at one of the days, they were in the round hall. They were addressed afterwards by Gemma O'Doherty and John Waters. The case was then moved to a different courtroom, and roads were blocked off by the Gardaí, and only certain people were allowed in. So obviously Gemma O'Doherty and John Waters had objected to this and argued that the public had a right to be present in court. The judge said that this wasn't possible because of the social distancing regulations that are in place, and the need to have people spaced out in the court. A courtroom in any day can be very kind of claustrophobic and oppressive place, and in such as you know, as a court reporter, sometimes you can be jammed up against people on the bench. Obviously, that's not ideal in the current circumstances. So the judge said that members of the media who wish to report were facilitated, and he said that most members of the general public acquire their knowledge of court cases through the media. So he was satisfied that the hearings were heard in accordance with the constitutional imperative for justice to be done in public.
All right. Thanks, Orla.
Thanks, Tom.
Now, finally today, if you've been chasing a refund or wondering about the chances of foreign travel in the coming months, stay with us. The European Commission shared its thoughts on the matter, and our political correspondent Paul Cunningham was going through what they had to say when I dialed him up in Leinster House earlier. Paul, how are you?
I'm doing very well. Thank you very much, Colm.
Good. Planning anything good this summer?
This summer? Well, I'm still hoping that it'll be possible to escape down to the bolt hole that is West Cork. And the feeling here is that that's Leinster House I'm talking from. The feeling here is that that is probably likely, even if buildings and businesses are not operating in the same way that they were. But further afield, I'm making no plans, because just from what I'm reading and from what I'm seeing, I don't think you could have any expectation that you can be guaranteed to get somewhere and then guaranteed to get back.
And what are you reading, Paul? What is the document and why do you think that?
Well, it is a big, thick document which has just been released by the European Commission, which is acting as a guide or advice on the approach Brussels is going to take on reopening. But you have to enter a very large caveat, which is that just because the European Commission actually publishes a plan, it does not mean that that plan is now set in stone, is going to be delivered, because in that wonderful way in which the European Union operates, there is national competence. And in some areas, the member states can do what they want. And in other areas, the European Commission has primacy and can tell you what to do. And if you don't do it, it'll take you to court. So what we have is a rather mixed picture.
Okay, so with regard to the travel restrictions, what's the European Commission advising? That all things going right, what would they advise if airline travel and tourism is to get back on track?
Well, the first thing they recognise is that this is a massive, massive part of the European system, accounting for millions upon millions of jobs and a massive percentage of how money is made. And so they're very careful in that, in as much as they recognise that, what they're trying to do is to counterbalance, walk on a tightrope, if you want to say, about public health, which is obviously of critical importance. So what you don't see within this plan is necessarily dates. You see sort of general phases. So there's three phases. We're in phase one, which is that most countries have closed borders to all but essential travel and frontier workers. So that's where we are. It then talks about a second phase, which would see travel restrictions and border controls gradually being lifted. So we're not seeing a date here. What you're effectively seeing is, you know, this is being analysed as member states share information about their population, share data about COVID-19, their infections and all the rest of it. So gradually lifting these border controls and restrictions. And the way they do that is through initially through regions of one country, areas or member states where there are similar situations on both sides of the borders. That would sound something like the relationship between the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland. And then the second, what they call the second, but ultimately the third phase, involves lifting all COVID-19 related controls on EU's internal borders, so everything inside the EU, while keeping necessary health measures in place. And what it doesn't go on to say, but I guess what it's suggesting is until we get a vaccine and we can deal with COVID-19 in totality.
So at that would be the point at which the Schengen area would have free movement as it was previously between all countries, where people could get in their car in the Netherlands and drive down to the lake region of Italy and go on their holidays, or indeed down to Spain, as the Dutch tend to do every year.
Yeah, well, I think it isn't just, I mean, they're not making a differential between Schengen and non-Schengen, that area, the countries who have agreed that they can travel sort of cross borders without anything, or Ireland, which is outside of Schengen. They're basically saying that it will revert back to the way it was, whether you're in Schengen or not. So that seems to be the differential, because while Schengen countries is a bloc within the European Union, not all Schengen countries acted in the same way. They took different approaches. So there's a complication there at the heart of it too.
So any pointers towards airlines and what they might do and what kind of precautions they might take if they are to take to the skies, and as Ryanair is hoping to get some more flights going by July?
Yeah, they gave some indications. They broke it down into two blocks. One was sort of people, customers, travellers, what they might or might not have to do, and then companies and the obligations that would be placed upon them. So when it came to passengers, they're going to be, or we're going to be, encouraged to buy tickets, you know, to check in online, to accept physical distancing, and that it's going to be obligatory at security queues, at luggage drop-off and collection points, on buses, on trains, on ferries, that there may be fewer people allowed to be on board, passengers not from the same household may be seated apart. So there's a number of flags they're waving there. But when it comes to the companies, that they may be obliged to install protective barriers between passengers and drivers where appropriate. They've also got real sort of practical stuff that doors, say, on trains and buses should open automatically so the passengers can avoid touching handles and buttons. And then also things that there may be new measures, which mean that food and drinks can no longer be purchased on board to minimise contact. Ventilation has to be strengthened. So they go down into the detail of both what a passenger is going to have to accept and also what a company is going to have to do. And, you know, for example, one of the things it says, where possible, passengers should wear masks and follow the rules laid down by national health authorities. And that's a classic example of where the Commission, on the one hand, is trying to make a general principle, we should wear masks. But on the other hand, it says it's up to the individual member state to apply that advice as how they best see fit.
The hope, presumably being, Paul, that countries which have been economically extremely badly affected, those that are dependent on tourism like Spain, Italy, Greece, where the poorer regions of those countries are largely almost totally reliant on tourism, that if they could get back on track at some point in this summer, maybe some of the economic pressure could be taken off the European Union.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, even if you think of tourism to the Irish economy, it's estimated to be worth 6 billion. Apply that right across the European Union. I think there was a statistic reported by Reuters that it was 30 million people are employed in tourism across the EU. So everyone recognises just how big this is. And yet, on the other hand, they also accept that it is public health which is to drive government policy. And if you get that wrong, you risk that that horror that is sort of there on the horizon, that you get the second wave of infection. We all have to be locked down again. But there are places where the Commission is asserting its own control on areas that it does have competence. And one of the things it said was that officials are saying they're not under any circumstances going to accept that passenger rights will be watered down. Take, for example, the obligation to be able to get a cash refund if a flight is cancelled. And already the Commission said it's instituting initial legal measures to take 12 member states to task, but they're facing infringement proceedings for allegedly breaching passenger rights when it comes to these cash refunds. So I was just on to the Department of Foreign Affairs to say, are we one of those dirty dozen?
Are we?
Is Ireland hands-free? And I haven't got a reply just yet, so I hope to be following that one up later on today.
Thanks, Paul. Thanks for that.
Pleasure, Colm. Anytime.
Cheers. All the best. Good luck. Safe journey to Cork.
Indeed.
All the best. Bye.
See ya. Cheers.
And since that interview, Paul confirmed that Ireland is not facing legal action, so a good day for the state in the High Court and indeed in Brussels. And that's all for this episode of Pandemic. We're back tomorrow with more. In the meantime, do get in contact with suggestions or questions by email to colm.omongain@rte.ie. That's colm.omongain@rte.ie or on Twitter @ColumOmongain. Do subscribe through your usual podcast platform to get this podcast regularly. Reviews are welcome, and of course, nice reviews even more welcome. So until tomorrow, take care. S'long.